Regardless, the name of the test is GREYS, plural, G-R-E-Y-S. That's the atomic bomb that went off an hour after Kennedy is killed, is Project GREYS.
Wow.
I've said this before, and I mean, I know other people have also said it, but just like these powerful events, whether it's 9/11 or the Kennedy assassination, these world shaking events have a kind of psychic resonance to them that it should be expected that synchronicities and these odd occurrences will cluster up around these events. But that one's, I did not know that one. That one's pretty amazing. I just wrote about this recently in another essay where there's an author, Richard Matheson, who's written all kinds of science fiction short stories as well as screenplays for film. But he wrote a screenplay that was Steven Spielberg's first, big hit. It was a made for TV movie called Duel that was done in the mid 70s and maybe even the early 70s. And the event was based on Richard Matheson and a friend of his. I can't remember the friend's name right now. I want to say Richard Saul, but that might not be right. The story Duel was about a giant truck that was sort of stalking and intimidating and very menacing and threatening to a lone driver out in the desert. That was based on a real life event that took place on the day of the Kennedy assassination that was experienced by both Richard Matheson and this guy, something Saul, Robert Saul, you know, something like that. I could look it up, but both of those people went on to, you know, the guy Saul, directed Twilight Zone episodes and Star Trek episodes and wrote the script for, science fiction, pop culture things, as did Richard Matheson. So, you know, both these people have this weird kind of, and then also Duel was, you know, an incredibly popular film and catapulted, young Steven Spielberg right to the heights of Hollywood, you know, right away. That also being tied into the Kennedy assassination is, to me, was, I thought that was, you know, well worth noting.
Are you familiar with, there's a movie, one of the few movies that Stephen King directed called Maximum Overdrive?
Oh no, I can't remember that. Yeah, I remember the name, but what's it about?
It's basically a strange green aurora borealis happens, coinciding with a comet passing, some like weird stuff, astrological alignment, and all the machines, particularly vehicles, come to life and start killing all the humans. And it's about people trying to get away. But there's a sort of leader of the machines is this big tractor trailer truck. And on the front is the face of the Green Goblin, the Spider-Man bad guy.
Uh-huh.
So you have this sort of truck connected to the Green Man, whether that's Osiris or Green, Little Green Men, however you want to take that. But connected there, and I, in my mind, I can't think Green Goblin without thinking of the Spider-Man movie and the connection to 9/11, where they had to pull the scene of Spider-Man between the Twin Towers and all that sort of stuff. But,
didn't the Green Goblin, wasn't he played by
William Dafoe?
William Dafoe, who also played Jesus.
Yeah.
He played Jesus, and also he's in Lars von Trier's Antichrist, where it's supposed to be the woman that's Antichrist with the Venus symbol and all of that, but then he's opposite her. And so there's this weird thing there where he's Christ, but then he's also the Antichrist.
Yeah.
I just had a weird dream with William Dafoe the night before last that I went back and forth talking about recently with all these things coming up around it where that basically involved time travel and atomic bombs. So I'm tripping out on that right now. And I think it's partly because I watched that film Antichrist with Jesus Christ Superstar, Marilyn Manson's Jesus Christ Superstar, just to see what would happen. And it had a really weird effect on me.
Huh. So. Well, that's okay. That's an interesting way to take this. So, Mike, you might not know this, but the two other guys in this call, David and Bill, they do a lot of these media experiments where they take movies and pair them with albums, kind of like your classic Wizard of Oz, Dark Side of the Moon.
Oh, yeah, Dark Side of the Moon, yeah, sure.
But they do these series of experiments, and this was very much on my mind as the other day I watched, this is just two nights ago, I watched Frank Zappa's 200 Motels. I don't know if anyone's ever seen that.
Yeah.
But there's a whole... there's a whole avenue I don't want to go down and take Mike's time, but essentially what I realized while watching it was a number of things, and the directly correlated to the experiments that you guys do, which is that 200 Motels is one of the few movies where it's a, you know, there's all these slew of movies made for music, like your Magical Mystery Tour and all these things, which are really bad movies, in my opinion. But 200 Motels is one of the few that actually... instead of trying to make a movie about the music or that's kind of like it or it's kind of trippy or blah, 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 instead, it's a movie that's made the way the music is made. It's a movie that looks like what the music sounds like. And I think what you guys are doing, and it occurs to me that, you know, taking a Pink Floyd and matching it up with Stanley Kubrick, let's say 2001 A Space Odyssey, is because they're both these sort of... long, timely, spacey things. So it's something that actually looks like the music sounds like. Beautiful, intricate, you know, all these sort of things. So I'm going through this in my mind. After I'm done watching it, they flash this thing at the end of the movie in the credits, but I couldn't make it out what it says. It's like some typed up note, and I couldn't read it. So I'm Googling around, you know, end credits and blah, blah, blah for 200 Motels, trying to figure out if there's a website that can say what this says. Couldn't find it, but what I did find is apparently 200 Motels was filmed on the same set as Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, and mm-hmm. the monolith can be seen in the background in a number of shots.
Yep, I heard that.
So like, yeah. It's weird to me that I'm watching this thing thinking about 2001 Space Odyssey, and meanwhile, the monolith is hiding in the back. In the background,
that's right there.
Yeah, so that's
and then you get into Kubrick, you know, faking the moon landing, mm-hmm. also on that same set,
right?
Supposedly, you know, like the moon set.
Yeah, well, which I sort of, if I was like, if that's true, I don't think that's where you, like, looking at the set of 200 Motels doesn't really seem to me. I don't know. It was a hard leap for me to then make that's where the moon landings are faked. But what I kind of wanted to take this to, Mike, is you had done this excellent post, which is connecting 2001 A Space Odyssey and Planet of the Apes. And it occurred to me a few weeks ago, I wondered if anyone had ever tried taking, let's say, take 2001 A Space Odyssey, play it, and then where they're flying out over that lake, which is the same lake, I wondered
Lake Powell in Utah, sure, yep.
Yeah, and I was wondering what would happen if you tried to sort of stitch them together, in a sense, at that correlation point. Since one ends with the wormhole over Lake Powell and the other one begins with the wormhole over Lake Powell, if you sort of stitch those together and tried to see it as one narrative, do you, it was just a thought that I had as a media experiment, but I wonder if you would speak at all to that research you did between the correlations of 2001 and Planet of the Apes.
That was a kind of a funny post because I can't remember. I realized that both, at a certain point, I realized that both 2001 and Planet of the Apes were released in 1968. And then I looked online and I realized that they were released 3 days apart. You know, and 3 days has got such a mystical resonance. You know, Christ was dead and then rose again 3 days later. You know, so these two movies were basically, with all these correlations, you know, the ape, you know, the ape makeup, you know, they both were like a stunt, you know, like that was kind of a, I'm old enough to remember, you know, how the hype of that, you know, I would have been the perfect age. What about 68? I would have been about 6 years old, to remember, like, you know, on the news, like it was all about the ape makeup in Planet of the Apes. And also in 2001, it had that spectacular ape makeup. You know, so all of a sudden these little parallels started showing up, and then, I had also read a book called The Watchers by Raymond Fowler. Now, Raymond Fowler is an interesting character. He's a UFO researcher. He wrote the reference I was talking about earlier, the Betty Andreasen case, was called the Andreasen Affair, and that spurred like four other books, you know, following her case. So you stack those books on top of each other. There's like probably 2,000 pages of her story. In the book The Watchers, it talks about someone earlier was saying that we are somehow interconnected. Alien is the wrong term because that implies it's elsewhere, where it's really us, it's really internal. Now that may be actually physical, like for instance, all the talk of DNA manipulation and such, some people will say we are the aliens because we are their creation, that they actually manipulated our genes. From now, our closest living relative genetically on the planet is the chimpanzee. It used to be that, people would say, oh, we're 99% same genetically. And I looked that up and someone corrected this, 95% the same genetically, which is still shocking when you think about it. But if you look at a chimpanzee's unborn fetus, you look at that fetus and it looks very much like a human. Embryology is a study. You study the fetal development of these embryos, and it seems like, and so now you take the next step. So you take a human. Now their unborn fetus looks remarkably like the gray alien, or the big-headed baby at the end of 2001 is obviously the personification of that fetus as genetically enhanced humanity, at the hands of this alien intelligence. So you have this triad, you have the chimpanzee, you have the human, and you have the big-headed gray alien. So the thought is, did the UFO occupants come down to Earth, manipulate the chimpanzee, and the way they would do that would be by manipulating the fetus? So the next stage in that evolutionary journey would be the human. Now, if you look at the human's fetus, it looks like the gray alien. Now, what we are also seeing, and this is just rampant in the literature, and there's a lot of people who will just say that it's like a contagious hysteria where it's not really happening. It's just people's projection, having read one story and then they project it on themselves and they tell the second story and it just, this feeding frenzy. But that doesn't really play out because what I've spoken to a lot of women directly who have had the abduction experience in their life, and they will talk about these genetic experiments that have to do with their baby, their unborn child, being removed by these gray aliens. I mean, that just shows up. It's almost, I'm very cautious to say 100%, but it feels almost universal among any woman abductee will tell that story of recent years. So you have this genetic lineage, and now that shows up in both. It shows up very obviously, super cleanly in a narrative linear line in 2001. Starts with the apes, they get genetically modified. The next thing we do is we jump to the humans, and then the final 17 minutes of the film is introduces this alien hybrid, genetically enhanced, fetus. And in a way that happens also in 2001, except it's all mixed, in Planet of the Apes, except it's all mixed up. So that was the sort of premise. Once I started playing around with those ideas and just kind of like, and I'll have to say that it, as silly as it sounds, freaking Google is outrageous for collecting these things. You just type in, imagery 2001 ape, and then all of a sudden you come up with something else. But there was also a very similar Outer Limits episode called The Sixth Finger. And that actually had the same triad that had started with chimpanzees, went to human, and then went to genetically enhanced superhuman with a great big bald head that looked like a gray alien. So once I went down this rabbit hole, it just seemed like everything was connected.
In Planet of the Apes, what is the evolved being?
Now that was where I had to cheat, and I kind of they find a little baby doll in the archaeological site where Roddy McDowall, Cornelius, played by Roddy McDowall, you know, finds a little big-headed baby with Messi.
Yes.
It's falling out. So it and it has this creepy sort of. I mean, little dolls that are old and dirty look creepy anyway, but you know that was sort of the linchpin of the whole thing. You know, like they have this argument, and Kim Hunter, who plays Zira, Cornelius's wife, you know, says, you know, the proof that the doll, and they have this argument between Zeus, you know, Zeus, or Heywood Floyd, you know, the keeper of the secrets, the bureaucrat who's trying to you know, hide everything from the populace. You know, they have this argument over the doll, because the doll is the proof that there was some sort of genetic lineage that connected them to something in the ancient past, where that's all flipped around in Planet of the Apes, you know, where it would be connected to our distant future here for us.
I really want to throw something in here. I read your that post and it blew me away. And shortly after, I started looking into some things, and I found that Kira D'Elia, probably pronouncing that wrong, but David Bowman in 2001, that he also played Alicia in Give Us Barabbas, which was a weird, whatever, Hallmark film about when you have the two Jesuses who are basically being put before the people, and they're choosing which one they're going to crucify. And, you know, it's the whole thing of Give Us Barabbas is let Jesus Christ be crucified, and we'll take Jesus Barabbas, which is kind of a joke. You have Jesus, which is Yod Heh Vav Heh with a shin in the middle. It's basically the name of God with the shin. It's a symbolic name, right? And so they're playing along with this whole thing. But then I found it especially weird that Barabbas himself in the film is played by Honorius from Planet of the Apes, who's the one who's talking about the apes' Old Testament. He's the religious figure of the apes. I just found that very, like, really kind of a weird sync there, especially considering that I've been relating Jesus in my mind, for whatever reason, to the Greys. I see the image of Jesus, the Aryan Jesus, the classic way that it keeps being thrown around, and the classic image of the Greys' face. And the thing with the Greys is I can't help but look at them like they're a composite of all the races. They're a composite of both the sexes or whatever. They're basically everything all at once in a single entity. They're like the unification itself in physical form, right? Symbolically represented. Which, if we're looking at all of this in this and like synchronicity as the language of the thing, it would make sense, you know, as an extension of that being its identity. What do you think of that?
I mean, this, you know, once you go down this rabbit hole, it's like the spider webs go everywhere. The Jesus as alien thing, I mean, that's something that shows up all the time. Like, you can't get, you know, you sit at the bar at a UFO conference and that comes up all the time. It's like, you know, here's all this proof that, you know, this, you know, the Star of Bethlehem, is that a UFO? You know, the three wise men, are they men in black? You know, the angel Gabriel coming to visit the Virgin Mary, is that like sounds exactly like, exactly, you know, what I was talking about earlier, where like these women talk about pregnancies, you know, like non-sexually active, often very young women will have, you know, symptoms of pregnancy, and then they'll have a UFO abduction, and the fetus will be taken. And then there's also plenty of stories where the you know, people who claim the UFO abduction lore will have children, and then the children will be extremely smart. There's a fellow and his son are both talking now. His name is Thomas Reed, and the son goes by a pseudonym Chase. And you know, the son has psychic abilities as well as you know, extremely high IQ. After just learning how to play chess, he beat a chess master. You know, so there's these odd that the boy Chase is now 18 years old, I think. So the Jesus alien connection is just as playful and just as fun, in essence, when you make these connections, because the, you know, the literature is so rich and it's so easy to do in a way. But you know, the it's very, the image of Jesus is very mysterious anyway. And that's one of the things that I have a soft spot for biblical epics, and I'm always shocked at how Jesus never smiles in any of his, in any of the portrayals of him in on film. You know, he never smiles. There's one scene in a movie called King of Kings where Jeffrey Hunter, who plays Jesus, there's a very brief scene where he's like sort of walking through the streets and the kids are running through the streets, and it's kind of this sunny day and the kids are having fun, and he kind of walks among the kids and smiles, and it just kind of like made me shudder. It's like, holy shit, that's the first time ever in the, you know. So so that bland, emotionless gray alien, you know, is, doesn't smile unless it's at the end of a Close Encounters,
right? Well, Bill had mentioned Lamb, Aleister Crowley's depiction being like the earliest depiction of the Greys that we know of. And Lamb is actually a Tibetan word. It's actually the same word that's used for the Dalai Lama, intentionally so by Aleister Crowley. And so I can't help but find it interesting that when we cloned, the first clone we ever did of the sheep, we happened to name it Dolly. Meanwhile, you have the Dalai Lama, while Lamb comes from the same word as llama. Like, do you see? Like, it's kind of a funny little parallel there. I don't know.
You know, the guy who invented, well, the guy who invented in vitro fertilization, he was a gentleman named Richard Seed. You ever know that story about Dr. Richard Seed?
Is this a joke?
This is not a fucking joke, man.
Are you serious, Dick Seed?
I'm telling you, man. I'm telling you. And look at Google it, man. Go to the crystal ball. And like right around the time when they were discussing the first cloned animal, Dolly, you know, Richard Seed went in the news and said, "Give me $6 million, I'll clone you a human being today." But anyways, you can go look all that up, and
it's the $6 million man who, you know, like, anyway, keep going.
But he,
my mind went the same place. Yeah,
I know his son. Dr. Richard Seed lived on the same block as one of my really, really good friends in Oak Park, Illinois, and so I got to hear stories about the real man, Dr. Richard Seed. And it's probably, save that for a later date. It's bizarre. I had tried to write a movie script about this gentleman and what I learned about him, but it's, no one would believe it. No one would believe it. It's absurd.
You're killing me with the sink here. I watched Prometheus last night for the first time, and to think of a Dick Seed, in terms of how the alien gets distributed to that woman, and then with the rose, and it's like a play on Rosemary's Baby. The guy comes out with a rose right before he gets it on with the woman, before he implants an alien fetus into her. Anyways.
Well, here's this. In 200 Motels, the scene in which the monolith is in the background is they're singing a song about a dick. It's literally a song about a dick, and there's the monolith. And they do this sort of weird thing where it's almost like they're playing up the monolith as this sort of almost phallus worship that they do earlier in the movie. And yet, I don't know, just to carry through this idea that, Mike, you were suggesting that in 2001, that first monolith would almost be the point at which the genetics are altered. So this is, to continue playing with this pun, is the Dick Seed or whatever it is, that's that moment. And now there was a guy, Michael Tesarion, who I'm not big into his research, but he was one of the first people that I had heard years ago talking about the idea of genetic manipulation and all this sort of stuff. And he was proposing that the term Genesis, the first book of the Bible, that Genesis was actually the genes of Isis, that these were the beings who had played with that have manipulated humanity's DNA, the genes of Isis. And I can't help but think that Planet of the Apes ends with Isis on the beach there, the Statue of Liberty.
Huh. Well, that's a stretch, bare sheet. But, I mean, you could say when we came up with the English for that, I don't know.
Again, I'm not, I don't know, Michael Tesarion is not a source that I would rely on heavily. I just thought it was sort of interesting. That one phrase has kind of stayed with me, that I thought that was fairly interesting.
It's creative. I like it. What are you? Okay.
But, you know, okay, so...
There's a bear of sheet in the woods.
Does... I guess, for me, this is where the whole UFO thing, for me, the crux of the whole issue for me is kind of with the whole creation thing. Like, is it important to know for a fact if the ancient astronauts is true, if alien genetic manipulation occurred, if the UFO abduction experience is real, okay? I think it's Jacques Vallée who talks about, why focus on the evidence, focus on what is it doing to our lives. So is that part of the scam, is when someone tries to force you to believing a truth into a creation or an existence kind of angle? You know, is it a waste of time trying to prove where do we come from? I mean, is that the point, or are we missing the point with that?
Well, you know, the can you hear me? I don't know if I just...
Yeah, we got you.
Yeah, you're
okay, great. So you know, like the actual Watson and Crick, you know, I can't remember which one it was. I think it was Crick, Francis Crick, I think is his name. The guy who... The team of Watson and Crick came up with the double helix as the way that's sort of solved, you know, the mystery of DNA. And he said in later years, and it was a little bit in jest, it's my understanding, kind of sort of researching it, you know, he kind of in exasperation said, you know, like, ugh, you know, the only thing that really explains the complexity of DNA is that it, you know, it's it was came here from another, from an alien race, like that was what was seeded here. And also I think that if I'm remembering this correctly, he, you know, just I think one of them recently was still alive or just recently died, and before he died confessed that the imagery, the solution of the double helix in DNA came while he was on LSD. You know, he basically solved it, you know, on a psychedelic drug. So, you know, what does creation actually mean? Does it mean like just a few molecules of like this impressive chain of amino acids? Is that all it took? Or was it like a grand event involving, you know, flying saucers and somehow magically manipulating life? I mean, some people say, oh yes, you know, we are a product of human alien genetic manipulation, you know, and then they just sort of start it there, you know, where does it actually go all the way back to like the primordial ooze and the planet was seeded here by some other intelligence? So yes, that's, my sense is it's more fun to go all the way back to the primordial ooze, you know, and then Prometheus, you know, certainly plays on that, you know, to a ridiculous amount, that whole plot line.
There's a ridiculous sync happening for me right over here. I have two cards in my hand that just happened to be in front of me on my desk here from Dinosaurs Attack, which was like a Tops, like...
Oh, weird. I know that, like, very well. Yeah.
Okay, so I just happened to have a card in front of me that, one, it says experiments in space, and it's all of them approaching the satellite up in space, and it's the second card of the deck. And then the next one in my hand is 53, which is Prometheus Explodes, which the space station itself was called Prometheus, and then here it is exploding. It's just funny, because like, I can't not say it, because it's in front of me, you know?
There's a guy online. He runs a site called Transmissions from the Imaginal, and his pen name is Dan Mitchell, and he's a pretty intense guy, and I love his written stuff. He's really smart and really digs deep, but he is he pretty overtly, you know, is points out that this game of connect the dots with synchronicities, he says, is cheapening, you know, a profound mystical experience. And that may or may not be true. But, you know, I just, when I interviewed Jake Kotze and I asked him about that, you know, like, what's it like, you know, why do you connect, you know, the ancient hieroglyphs on the wall of an Egyptian temple and then connect that to The Simpsons? And without skipping a beat, he kind of goes, well, because it's fun. And I mean, to me, that's as good of an answer as any. You know, I mean, I enjoy the playful nature of how these things sort of well up.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you're also able to take a serious researching role also, which I think, again, you know, that's a rare thing where people seem to go to one extreme or the other. I give you a lot of credit for being very serious about your research and at the same time also understanding that, you know, every now and then throwing your hands up in the air and going, all right, let's just laugh at it.
Yeah, and Chris Nolan's pretty good at that too, yeah.
If you're not open, you know, it's hard for some of the biggest gems that you end up finding that are like really like, wow, I really can't explain that, are the result of just being receptive, you know? And so there's definitely like, you know, it's like the Willy Wonka little nonsense now and then relished by the wisest men, you know, it's like there's definitely some value in that receptivity. And so you gotta pay attention when you're looking at Donald Duck, you know, the same way that you have to pay attention when you're studying ancient hieroglyphs.
Yes, and I think it was Jake Kotze who talked about, you know, we live, you know, like if we all lived in the forest, right, and we are all, you know, still in a tribal society, you know, are the things that we would interact with would be, you know, the seasons and the sunrise and butterflies and lily pads and, you know, flowers along the path and interactions with wild animals. You know, we don't live in that world anymore. We interact with, you know, beer commercials and The Simpsons and kind of lowbrow movies. So, and you know, what he puts forward is that, you know, so the synchronicities are going to emerge. They need to emerge. It's just part of the framework of reality that these things want to just well up. And, you know, so that's where they're welling up, you know, in the very thing that we have before our eyes, which is, you know, kind of like tawdry pop culture as opposed to, you know, the jungles of Brazil or something.
Yeah, it's like nature will find a way, you know.
Well, yeah, reality.
We're bird watchers, aren't we? I mean, when I grew up, it seems like when I grew up, there used to still be bird watchers. Like that was a thing.
Oh, well, there still are. Yeah,
there still are. But I mean, when's the last time you met a fucking bird watcher? I haven't. I live in the city, so.
You good friends, sir.
Okay, that's awesome. So it's still out there. It's beautiful. Okay, it's humming along. But as a kid, you know, the idea of when I'm playing video games, I got TV, and I'm playing sports, like, the idea of someone, they would, on a Saturday afternoon, like, they're a bird watcher to go out, and they look for birds. And it just seemed like the most boring excuse for sort of a social activity. It just, I couldn't wrap my head around it, and it just seemed odd. But sync is very much like bird watching, you know? It's not about, it's so much more than birds, you know? It's about the way it all flows into your awareness that, you know, elusive things that shouldn't be there appear, and certain birds become resonators for certain things in your life. And as you carry this focus throughout your life, it reflects and rewards you by developing channels into experiences that you never would have had if you didn't birdwatch. Or you would have had them, but they become clearer because of birdwatching. So I think that I really like what you just said about Jake Kotze's interviews, because that really kind of snapped it home for me. Is that why am I a birdwatcher? Well, because it's fun. I'm not going to sit here and explain to you for 5 hours why I do it and give you the whole tale in a passing conversation. So most of the time, if someone asks me, I'll just say it's fun, and just leave it at that. And you know what? It pretty much, that's a pretty good way to capture it, I think.
Yeah, and I liked that about his thing. So there's a researcher that shows up at every UFO conference. His name is Donald Ware. He's probably getting close to 80. and he was a member of MUFON, and then I think he got kind of kicked out. I can't remember how the story plays out, just because his thoughts, his ideas were getting too strange for a sort of a rigid group like MUFON. But he, you know, and he's also a very avid birder. So, you know, birdwatcher, they'll call themselves birders. And when he hands you his business card, it simply says Donald Ware, UFO researcher, birder.
Watching the skies either way, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I have a sort of soft spot for bird watching. It's kind of interesting. You know, you see a bird and there's like, you know, there's birds that, you know, birds migrate and stuff like that. So it's interesting when they show up and they're colorful. And so.
When looking at your article there, when you talk about the orange light and there's 2 hours that are unaccounted for you, this is kind of funny. So every year for the last 6 years, when I go to Burning Man, I have a friend named Orange who wears all orange. His tent is orange. Absolutely everything he owns is orange. And this guy is from Germany. And he plays this role of he is an alien. He comes from Orange Guiana, or whatever I should know at this point, what the name of his planet is, but something along those lines. And he will not relinquish the character. And for one night every year, he has the alien landing, where he basically brings literally thousands and thousands of orange glow sticks and has everybody break them at the same time and throw them up in the air repeatedly, so that basically the whole desert can see, like if they're looking in the general direction, all of this orange, just like orange, orange, orange. And he is just completely devoted to this cause no matter what. And I mean, I've seen it for 6 years, but he's been doing it longer than that. And I couldn't help but, like, when you say this orange light with this alien landing idea, it just totally just, like, kind of was like, huh, interesting, orange, wow.
And orange shows up a lot in the you know, UFO lore, you know, whether that's the color of the, you know, this. I just did a recent interview with this guy, Grant Cameron, and, like, the last half hour of the interview, he's talking about this event that took place in Canada in the early 70s where people were seeing these orange orbs. And then there's actually a woman named Regan Lee who has a blog called The Orange Orb because of a profound sighting she had with her husband. And it's really interesting because they've been married for I don't know how many years. You know, she must be in her 50s. And then they just recently were interviewed because they saw that together, and they were interviewed, and then they remembered the event completely differently. You know, this event, because I think they were on the motorcycle together. She was on the back of his motorcycle. This happened in the 70s, I think. And the orange orb thing, there's actually a UFO researcher who has a blog called The Orange Orb. Anyway, I just think, so yeah, that color orange is part of the whole, you know, that gets repeated a lot.
Mike, there's another story, an older blog post that you have that I've been fascinated with and I've always wanted to ask you about. It's this one where you're out in the woods and you see what also looks like in this orange color. It's almost like a teacup saucer thing. You know.
Oh, that was a dream.
Right, but it's such an incredibly vivid dream, it seems like. Perhaps that's is that normal for you to have dreams that lucid, that vivid, or?
No, I note those dreams, you know, like I have to pay very close attention when I have a dream like that. Like I'll get up right away and you know, draw the images as best I can. And, you know, document those and ponder those. Yeah. So I haven't had one in a while to that extent, but when I have a dream like that, I will note it, you know, so that story. So I had this dream, I was having trouble sleeping. I was getting ready to drive to a UFO conference the next morning, and I had to get up really early. And that's the kind of thing where I will have unsettled sleep. And I woke up in the middle of the night and couldn't quite go back to sleep. And then suddenly, poof, I was asleep. And then I had that dream it was a lampshade in a forest. And I knew it wasn't a lampshade. Like I was in this very defined forest, had a very you know, the trees were very thin and very clean. There was no limbs at the bottom of these pine trees. And then the forest floor was very flat. And so, you know, I recognize that that is not a lampshade. And the next thing I know, I'm like, I'm being, you know, this is all in a dream. I'm not mistaking this for reality. And, you know, like I'm suddenly lifted up. It happens really fast. Like it doesn't happen like slow like you would see in a science fiction movie or something like that. Like I'm lifted up very fast. I'm moved to the side and then I'm dropped down into a hovering flying saucer. So anyway, all these other synchronicities are associated with that event. It to tell the story, it would take, you know, half hour, but it just goes on and on. But when I woke up, I got up and it seemed like I hadn't been asleep long enough, like looking at the clock. Actually, I was looking at a time counter on a podcast is how I knew I'd only been asleep for a little bit. And then I did something I've never done before. I went downstairs and got a voice recorder, went back upstairs, climbed back into bed. And while lying in bed with the light on, I recorded the dream. I basically said, okay, here's the dream. Here's the beginning. Here's all these odd things in the dream. And then I switched the recorder off and then turned the light off. And there was a glowing blue orb hovering above my bed. And it was very strange, you know, about the size of a grapefruit. And it was just, I probably would have needed to sit up a little bit in order to reach out and touch it, but it was pretty much within my reach. You know, seeing this, it faded away. And then I did something very unusual. I just went, huh, and then just rolled over and went right to sleep.
That's incredible. I encourage everyone listening to this to seek out that blog post because the illustrations are stunning. As all your illustrations are really stunning, but there's something that really captures this otherworldliness in that series of illustrations. But so then what I find too just kind of insane, and I don't mean that in an offensive way, insane on a personal level even, the fact that it's a lampshade, as what I notice reoccurring for me is as a younger child who was interested in comics, I would always draw these really terrible little comic books, you know, either in the margins of my notes at school or things like that. And I would just have pages and pages of all these little cartoon drawings. And I had this only race of aliens that I had, I called them the lampshades, and they were lampshades. They were like, they were lamps that would, they were actually aliens. And like that when people weren't looking, the lampshades would open eyes and they were aliens that were here and observing humanity, and they were lampshades. So on a personal level, that's just kind of almost chilling that to hear you say that. But to take it to your experience, the fact that you're here, you are, so you have the strange dream, and then that dream carries over into your waking state, that now it's no longer just a dream. This blue orb followed you into your waking life.
I mean, the implication is that, you know, like, and I'm very cautious to make this implication, so I'm speculating, I have no proof, is that the blue orb had actually projected that hyper vivid dream into my mind. You know, on the way to the UFO conference, I pick up this friend, her name is Natasha. We drive to Sedona. We're going to go to Sedona for a couple of days. She's coming from Germany. So I pick her up at the Las Vegas airport. We go to Sedona, and on the drive there, I have to pee in the woods, you know, so we're like driving on this little road. And I, you know, like, okay, let's stop the car. And I step into the woods to pee. And she walks into the woods and pees. And so we like get back in the car and I'm like, you know where you just were? That was the woods. That was exactly the woods that I dreamed about. You know, it was exactly the same. You know, Arizona has these, in Northern Arizona, you get these spindly thin pine trees and a very flat forest floor because the pine needles over the centuries just make it perfectly flat. So, you know, that matched perfectly. You know, there was a event in that dream where I pulled off a, what do you call it? Like a hieroglyph or something. I pulled it off this wall. It was hyper vivid. It was super strange. I held it in my hand. I remember in the dream saying, I have to remember this. And the image was, it was like a W with a hook around it. So we meet and we get to Sedona. We meet this guy. He's a Kabbalist and a astrologer. His name is Joseph Mark. And just a total Sedona character, you know, like exactly the kind of person you would imagine meeting there. And I say, hey, you know about symbolism. You know, what do you make of the symbol? And I draw it. I draw it on a napkin. We're at a restaurant together. And he looks at it. And I say, what does this mean? You know, the W with a hook at the end of it. And he says, well, and he turns the napkin upside down. It's my initials. And it was JM, like perfect, a perfect JM, like artistically created. But I wouldn't have thought of that unless I flipped it upside down. Yeah. And then I met another guy at the UFO conference. And this character is fairly famous. There's a fellow named Roger Lear who's been doing implant research. And he's one of the characters that had an implant removed from his toe. And it had all this, you know, that story goes on for, you know, a long time. But he told a story about being at a hotel in Flagstaff, Arizona, and sitting with his wife. And his wife in the middle of the night says, we should drive to Sedona. Let's drive to Sedona, which is about 45-minute drive away from Flagstaff. And he's like, I got a bad feeling about this. And she insisted. And they got in the car, and it was like 9 o'clock at night. And then they drove down this road. And all of a sudden she says, oh, we don't need to go to Sedona. Let's turn around. And they turn around, and they're missing 15 minutes of time, he figured out, somewhere in that trip. And I asked him, you know, where that event took place, because it rode outside of Sedona, and he got a map out and pointed to the site. And he actually took a picture of it. He went back there later and took a picture of the site. It wasn't exactly where I peed in the woods and saw the forest matching, but it was less than a mile away. So like all these little things are connected to that story of the thing. Now I just wrote lampshade down on a piece of paper here. Now, obviously a lampshade, the way I drew it, it does look like a flying saucer. You know, it's kind of a flat saucer shaped lampshade. But in the Gospels, there's a parable that Jesus tells. And he says, you know, like, you know, why would you put a lampshade over the lamp? You need to remove that lampshade and let the light shine out. You know, the metaphor being, you know, don't hide your relationship, you know, the God spark within you, you know, let it shine out. So, you know, so even in the parable from the Bible, they talk about lampshades in this mystical way.
The lampshade is almost the mask.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, it's a cover. Yeah. You know, like, and I think they, it's just in some translations, it's a basket, you know, and they say like, you know, the basket, you know, would hide the light of the lamp.
Well, then he goes on to say a house on a hill basically shines a light on what's below, which is, you could take it as the bait is house, and corresponds now with European occultists to the magician. So it's like the magician doesn't hide his magic, you know, he expresses it, so that there's no shame in expressing magic. When you open your article with the idea of that sink is magic, that was really potent. I couldn't resonate more.
Oh, and I did that on purpose, just basically because I was ignoring the logical side of my mind. You know, like that's like I was actively saying like, no, like, you know, there's a Dr. Kirby Surprise wrote a book about synchronicity, and he has a very formal, logical, scientific way that he talks about, you know, the causal relationship between, you know, a person's intention and the synchronicity. In a way it's fascinating, but in another way I'm kind of like bored with it. You know, like I resonate much better with, you know, what the heck, let's just call it magic.
Right. Well, faith isn't the guillotine of reason. It's not like faith is the absence of reason. Like it's what takes over when reason recognizes its limits. You know, like I couldn't overemphasize that. And magic itself can have a logical explanation. Like if you plant a seed and it grows, that's magic, you know, because you don't need to be able, like initially, like when we didn't know the biology and all these things, you know, we would do, we see the thing and there's a mystery in it. If you go deeper and deeper into it, you can't explain it. It's like a dog looking at a chess game, you know, it's like just because it doesn't understand it doesn't mean that there's no reason behind it, you know. And so magic is the same thing. It's just an acknowledgement or a humility of basically what we're capable of grasping and understanding, that we can, some with certain things we can only grasp so much, even with as much as we've come to understand.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. You know, we have the blinders on.
So I need to tell you here, What's actually really funny, Dr. Kirby Surprise also wrote a chapter for Sync Book 2. You know, to me, it's interesting to put these things sort of side by side. And I look forward to speaking to him because I'm not... I'm unsure about his position. As much as he sort of lays it out in very matter-of-fact terms, it also seems like he's saying... Yeah, he's one of the ones saying, this is an expression of your mind. Yes, you can do these things. You can have these amazing synchronicities, but they are an expression of your mind. It would almost seem to imply the mystical, that you, if you have the ability to shape your reality, is that not magic? So I would be very curious to ask him that question. But there's also, I just want to sort of throw out here, I mentioned to you, Mike, in an email last night, for the back cover of Sync Book 2, you know, we had on the first one, we had some quotes. And what I did for this one is I just pulled out a few quotes from the actual text of the book that I thought really spoke to the heart of the matter. And it's actually the first few sentences of your piece are on the back, going to be on the back cover of the book. And that little part where you say, this is what synchronicity is. Here's a shorter definition. Here's a shorter definition. Shortest definition, magic. And I just think that's so beautiful, so concise. And I understand you're saying that was almost being a little playful, being, you know, screw the rational for the moment. Let's just dive in. And I think that's kind of what needed to be done there. And I don't know, that opening sort of phrase kind of rings so true to me.
Yeah, oh, that's great to hear. Because I actually, when you said that, you sent an email and you said, oh, I you know, used a little quote. And I was like, oh, really? Oh, that's kind of cool. And then I actually had the document open on my desktop. And I'm like, and I my guess was the very last sentence of the essay. I scrolled right to that. And I was like, I bet you that's what he put on it. But it's funny that you put the very first one on it. And I had just sort of like, you know, my gut said, ooh, he put the very last one on.
The last shall be first.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I
was... Oh, here's... Just let me interrupt real quick.
Please.
Are you familiar with a guy named Gibbs Williams?
Sure, yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. Have you interviewed him?
No, he was actually on 42 Minutes 2 weeks ago, so I didn't get to interview him, but I listened to that.
Oh, and I got to listen to that. I'm a huge fan of that guy, yeah.
And I listened to your interview with him when you did it, I don't know, about a year ago. So that was really interesting because when actually they told me, they said, oh, we've got this guy, Gibbs Williams, coming on. I was like, oh, I remember hearing him on Mike Cleveland's podcast. And I really enjoyed that. And it's actually funny because what I've been playing over in my mind since I heard Gibbs Williams, and it's so funny that you mentioned Kirby Surprise, is I'm really interested to see if I can get both of them on together to have the two of them have a conversation because they take similar positions, but you know, this idea of an internal expression in the external, yet Gibbs, you know, makes this sort of very, very strong point of it's non-mystical. I mean, the name of his book is Demystifying Synchronicities, or excuse me, Demystifying Meaningful Coincidences. So I find this fascinating. Where is this? Again, not to be insulting, you know, is this an academic sort of need or knee-jerk to say, okay, yes, there's this really bizarre thing, but it's not mystical at all? And I almost get to the point of, well, what else would you call that? If you're saying that you can shape your reality and that these, you know, these things happen because they're an expression of your internal body politic, is that not you know, if that's not mystical, what is?
Yeah, oh, I agree, and that's sort of like, you know, we're grasping at like straws behind the curtain, right? So I mean, both these guys make a really good case for their explanation of synchronicity. You know, like, you know, the one thing is, you know, so you do a test, you know, you get people and you do a coin toss, right? And then people will get the coin toss statistically higher. You know, it should be 50-50, right? Every time they guess, it should be absolutely random. It should have no, you know, that's like the coin toss is like the personification of random. That's how you start a, you know, football game or something. But it's not random when you get right down to testing it. People do better. People know what the coin toss is going to be. They'll predict heads or tails statistically in a way that that says something else is going on. So there's two things could be going on. One is ESP, the person is predicting the future, or two, the person is actually affecting reality and changing, affecting the way the coin lands. So you know, that would be the implication of synchronicity, is that somehow you're changing reality. Hey, I just wrote down this little thing here. Right when we got started here, and I just want to, there's a little story that I want to share. Can you just let me go for a minute or two here?
Absolutely, yeah, please.
So there's a physicist. His name is Leon Lederman. I live in a little small town in Idaho, and he's got a second home here. And so he talked at the bookstore one time. He had a book which was called The God Particle, and I think he works in the Fermi Lab, and I think the Fermi Lab is in Illinois, connected to Northwestern University. I might not have that right. So he's like the senior physicist, or you know, the administrator of the Fermi Lab. He's got some high role there. I'm not sure exactly what it is. And he's a funny guy. He's Jewish, and you know, got the perfect, you know, wisecracking, you know, attitude that, you know, he's like one step away from being a stand-up comedian, which makes him really great, you know, to listen to. So he told the story in the bookstore, and then to me, when I heard that, I was like, oh, this is like a total metaphor for UFO research. But so the story he tells is, okay, there's this group of aliens land on Earth, and you know, they're very similar to us, but there's some differences. And as part of their sort of you know, like the tour of Earth, you know, the powers that be say, oh, here, we'll take you to a soccer game, you know, and you can watch the soccer game and enjoy it. And so this is something that Earthlings do. So they take them all to the soccer game, and they all sit in one row in the stands. And but unknown to the humans, these aliens have something going on in the internal mechanism of their eye, where it is impossible for them to see the black and white pattern of the soccer ball. So the soccer ball is invisible. So what happens is, they're watching this game, they have no idea what's going on because they can't see the soccer ball. There's people in one color uniform, there's people in another color uniform, they're running back and forth in the field, there's a guy in a striped shirt, he's doing something. So these people are all the highest scientists of their world that came to Earth, and they're sitting with their pen and paper, and they're scribbling out these computations, you know, like, okay, you know, when the referee puts his hand like this, everyone responds like this. So they write all these computations down. It's complete gobbledygook. It doesn't make any sense at all. And then at one end of the stands, there's the little young scientist that came along with them to Earth, and he looks out and he sees someone swing their leg, the back of the net does something in the goal, and then everyone in the audience like stands up and cheers. So he says, ah, there's something we're missing. There's an element that we're missing within this whole phenomena. And that element, you know, I have to surmise that there's some structure that they're kicking around on the field. So as soon as he says that, everyone says, oh, that makes perfect sense. So two things happen. One, through this deduction of looking at the clues, he solves the mystery. And two, all the computations that all the scientists have been writing down, these complex, mixed up computations, are actually true. You know, they're actually correct in what they say about, you know, how the teammates react to this, you know, to the methodology of the guy in the striped shirt. So, you know, I just thought that was so perfect a metaphor for, you know, us peering behind the curtain. So what's happened is Dr. Kirby Surprise and Gibbs William have both come up with similar but not totally the same conclusions about what might be happening with how synchronicities are created or projected. And to me, it doesn't matter that they're slightly off. You know, they're both, in essence, probably correct, the same way that those alien scientists were correct with their computations about what's going on in the soccer field.
Like I Heart Huckabees with the two doctors that are coming from completely polar places, yet are absolutely complementary and both complete each other. They're mutually interdependent, you know?
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Okay, so I want to sort of shift gears. Halloween's next week. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the paranormal. I know you're someone who, and that's, I know that's a vague term, but you're a researcher who sort of focuses on UFOs, that you also understand there's this correlation between fairy realms, I don't know, ghosts, what we might sort of lump under paranormal or fantasy, that there's this sort of strange connection there. And I just want to speak specifically for a moment to the more classic paranormal experience. Is that something you deal with, or have you ever experienced something like that?
You know, I'm not sure. You know, like, you know, my intuition, and I just always seem to go back to the UFO thing, but sure, you know, like, I mean, there's a, you know, the poltergeist activity is something that's reported in the homes of UFO abductees. You know, they talk about,
I mean, is that true?
Oh yeah, that shows up all the time. Where what happened, you know, like, and I asked Bud Hopkins about this when he was still alive. I talked to him in 2008 at length, and you know, and I said, you know, what about the poltergeist activity gets reported? And he told a story about in the house where an abduction had occurred, and the abductee's sitting on the couch, and he's looking across, and the lamp, here we're back to lampshades again, the lamp lifts up off the coffee table next to him, rotates in the air, and then sets back down on the coffee table upside down.
Yeah.
And then I had I spoke to one woman, and she talked about the gray aliens. She's a fascinating person. She's had, you know, an amazing experience. She's super funny and articulate about the way she writes about them. She has a blog called At Spiral's End. That's amazing. But she told a story where this is one I always go back to. You know, the little gray aliens are notorious for just opening a interdimensional doorway and just walking right through the walls and ending up in the house, and they're sort of caring and you know, without emotions. Now, she also has had experiences with the tall Nordics, or you know, the blondes, as they're sometimes called. And what they'll do is they'll land their flying saucer, you know, a few hundred yards away from the house, and then they'll walk right up to the door and actually knock on the door and turn the doorknob and walk in. And she has a story, you know, she has stories of both. And she says her hypothesis is the reason they do that is because the nearly human Nordic blondes recognize that the mechanism of coming into our reality opens up this window, this rift, and then like odd poltergeist experience come rushing through that open window. So when the you know, the blondes are polite enough that they don't want to invade someone's house with, you know, weird apparitions and poltergeists and orbs and creaky noises and stuff. So they'll land their flying saucer, you know, away from the house, where the grays will just open up a doorway and just walk right through the wall. And then when that happens, all kinds of other stuff rush through that same open window.
Yes.
And that it's this odd parallel dimensional stuff that we can't quite wrap our minds around. You know, we're just odd things will start happening. You know, TV sets will turn on and off, faucets will turn on and off. You know, all these stories are completely the norm in the realm of the abductee.
Okay, so, you've just thrown me for a loop here, because, you know, after I spoke to you last year, you know, you had sort of posed the question about UFOs, and I said, you know, it's something I have a mild interest in up to that point. And this sort of memory came back to me afterwards that my brother and I used to always have this thing where on certain nights, you know, sometimes in the winter, the sky will glow kind of pinkish red, this sort of snow glare. I don't know, maybe that's New York pollution or if that's everywhere, but it's very common in the winter for the sky to glow reddish pink. I mean, bright reddish pink here. So again, I don't know if that's true everywhere, if that's our air pollution. But my brother and I used to always refer to this as children. We used to always refer to this as the UFO sky. Like when the night looked like that, we would say to each other, "Oh, it's the UFO sky tonight." And this sort of phrase came back to me and said, "Why did we call it that?"